everyone. Welcome back to TYT, a completely new power panel. Do we have the animation ready? Yeah? No? Okay. Power panel. Hi, everybody. Anna Kasparian, Brian Unger, and Ambria Allen with you.
I thought the other panel was just too male.
Well, I mean
so I'm really glad that we've mixed this up a little bit.
You know, but it was a good panel. We have some women represented in the first hour.
They were a little too pro-military for me, but I liked the panel. It was good.
Right. You know. All right, we have some fun stories for you in this hour, and also some not so fun stories, but you don't want to miss the story about the $1,700 pants that rich people are buying. It's absurd, and it just further proves that rich people are so bored with their money that they don't know what to spend it on. So it's one of my favorite stories. But before we get to that, we actually do have a pretty serious story regarding Trump's immigration plan and the amount of resources we are going to spend on detaining undocumented immigrants. So let's get to that. GEO Group, which is one of the largest for-profit prison corporations, has just secured a federal contract in the amount of $110 million to build a new facility specifically meant to detain undocumented immigrants. Now, according to Talking Points memo, the GEO Group said that its 1,000-bed detention facility will be in Conroe, north of Houston, and will open by the end of next year. GEO already operates the 1,500-bed Joe Corley Immigrant Detention Center in the same small town. So it's a little strange that they need another for-profit prison to detain undocumented immigrants in the same area. But if you've been paying attention to our reporting here at the Young Turks, you've known that we've been covering for-profit prisons and how absolutely disastrous they've been, how they do not cut costs. They're not really private prisons, they're privately run. But they have investors and they want to make a profit. The whole point is to detain as many people as possible so they can make as much money as possible. And so if you're concerned about undocumented immigrants using up our resources, well, this is a perfect example of how detaining undocumented immigrants actually makes you, the taxpayer, spend your money on something that we shouldn't be spending on. But anyway, I want to give you guys a chance to chime in and I'll give you some more details to this story.
Well, it's not just Texas. It's also, these have been going on in Arizona. I know that I have family who actually worked in a medical facility that is privately run and owned and operated, and ICE kind of oversees it. So we have all these contracts with ICE that sort of facilitate the housing and warehousing of essentially immigrants. So if we're going to end this quote unquote catch and release program and we're going to basically warehouse people until we get their paperwork in order, until we ship them out. We're essentially starting another industry of essentially warehousing people who are, you know, in violation of the law.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's very, very costly.
It leads to a gigantic profit motive in criminalizing people who are simply coming here looking for a better life. And look, I understand we can't have a system where we just let people come in and we open our borders. No one's asking for that. But you want common sense legislation, you want common sense regulations to, you know, deal with this issue, and we're doing the exact opposite of that right now.
Exactly. I think it's interesting the way in which these immigrant detention centers are increasingly modeled after our criminal justice models, right? Mm-hmm. So even outside of detention centers, there are bond programs or other forms of surveillance systems, right? That look a lot like how we deal with criminal justice, which is also privatized. So I think when we examine this, we got to look at some of the racial structures, the economic imperatives that kind of undergird this issue and ask, why are these policies kind of forming in the way that they are?
Exactly. And so, you know, at the tail end of the Obama administration, Obama had made the decision to stop using federal or for-profit prisons on the federal level. Right. And so, of course, Trump came in and he completely undid that. The stock prices for these for-profit prisons shot up. And I'm sure after they secured yet another federal contract paid by our taxpayer money, the stock for GEO Group will shoot up again. And so you don't want to have this type of incentive, a profit motive structured into our justice system. But unfortunately, we do. And I was hoping that, you know, this system would get better after the Obama administration, but of course it's not. I mean, you have Donald Trump, who is a product of a corrupt political system. He's exploited that corrupt political system. What makes anyone think that he wouldn't do any favors for corporations like Geo Group? So to give you some more details on this, US Immigration and Customs Enforcement already has a record of more than 41,000 detainees. That number is expected to increase. And also the agency has also identified an additional 21,000 unused beds that it plans to use for detention. So understand that these for-profit prisons usually have contracts that indicate that the government, whether it's on a state level or a federal level, needs to provide a minimum occupancy rate, right? So let's say that these beds are not being used. Our taxpayer money still has to pay for the beds as if there are inmates there. And it creates an incentive where if there are unused beds, well, we just need to detain more people,
exactly,
right? And so that's another issue. Also, Trump has instructed ICE to detain all individuals suspected of violating immigration laws. As soon as you come into this country, you cross the border and you're undocumented, you're breaking the law in Trump's book, and you could be detained in one of these detention centers.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, they'll be filling up and they'll be, you know, building more of these facilities.
That's then. Right. That's right.
Yeah.
And conditions will probably decline, right, mm-hmm. as populations rise in you know.
Right, because if it's run like a business, think about it. They want to cut costs and maximize profits. So there have been a number of reports regarding for-profit prisons that, you know, there was just heinous behavior, you know, inhumane treatment of the inmates, not providing the necessary medical care. And so that's unsurprising when you run a prison like a business. So this is not a good situation, and I apologize that we're opening the second hour with such a depressing story, but this is you know, one of the many devastating, you know, outcomes of Trump's presidency and his administration.
Yeah, I mean, I had this family member who works in a facility in Arizona, and there had been no deaths, and they go out of their way. Mm-hmm. He's a nurse practitioner, and he goes out of his way, and they all do, to make sure that there's medical care for everyone mm-hmm. who needs it. And they're so closely monitored by groups that come through these facilities daily. Mm-hmm. Some of them very high profile, like John Legend comes through with a group and another mm-hmm. group. But so there's a lot of attention to make sure that everyone is cared for and fed. But it's like the idea of just stockpiling, warehousing, mm-hmm. or building facilities to detain anything while we don't address
yeah.
real issues. It's
right.
just another way of just,
yeah.
as you say, profit inducement mm-hmm. is sort of winning the day rather than really confronting the complexity of the issue.
Yeah.
And we have a Congress that doesn't want to confront it. So
no, they don't want to confront it because they're essentially paid by the same corporations who have an interest in keeping this going, right?
Exactly.
So this is their bread and butter. They're going to continue doing this, right? And you know, we have these conversations about the war on drugs and why marijuana on a federal level continues to be criminalized. It's still listed as a Schedule I drug, and people are like, that doesn't make any sense. Why is it happening? Well, it doesn't make sense to the electorate, right? But it certainly makes sense to the politicians. Mm-hmm. It makes sense to the people that are lobbying to continue prohibition because they make money off of it. Mm-hmm. So anyway, moving on to some good news. The heroin epidemic continues to be a problem in the United States, but some states have decided to take matters into their own hands and create policies that would help prevent the spread of diseases as a result of individuals sharing needles. So in Nevada, they have decided to install what is referred to as syringe vending machines. They're exactly what they sound like. Now, this is taking place specifically in Las Vegas. And the idea behind it is, well, these people are going to share these needles. They're going to spread hepatitis and HIV. And that is a public health issue. So we need to do something to at least prevent that from happening. They are accessible to clients of a program known as Track B Exchange. It's run by the Los Angeles Heart Reduction Center. Now, only people who are part of that program will have access to these vending machines. And in my opinion, that's actually one of the downsides. But what they want to do is keep track of their clients and make sure that they're getting the necessary help. But if you are not part of that program, you will not have access to the vending machines. Drug users can scan a card and enter a unique ID number in order to vend one of the colorfully gift wrapped boxes inside. I'm not sure why NBC News felt like the colorful like nature of the boxes is relevant,
but talking about drugs.
Yeah, yeah, it's weird, right?
Make it nice.
Oh, it's got to be colorful. Also available at 3 different locations by the end of May. Each client will be limited to 2 kits a week. Each box contains syringes, alcohol wipes, safe sex supplies, and a sharp disposal box. So this, I think some people get turned off by these ideas. You have countries like Canada, for instance, that have decided to like create these centers where if you're addicted to heroin, you can go there and safely inject it. And a lot of conservatives get turned off by that idea because they think it encourages people to do drugs. But I don't think anyone would hear about those centers and think to themselves, you know, I've never tried heroin before. Let me try some heroin and go to the center to do it. It's all about preventing the spread of diseases.
That's also their, you know, abstinence approach.
Yeah.
Right? If you give people condoms, then they're gonna wanna have sex, right? Instead of actually providing an avenue to have safe sex. Mm-hmm. I think that these approaches are in step with the data that show that these kinds of programs work in decreasing things like HIV and hepatitis C. And I also like that, you know, the article suggests that these programs are community-based, right? Mm-hmm. So in Vegas, it is this registration process, and I'd be interested in learning what the criteria are for mm-hmm. people who need to register, right? Because you mentioned that might be a downside, right? So, but you know, you can implement these systems in whatever community context based on the needs of that particular place. So I think that that's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
I like the idea. I'm just not sure it's like really practical.
Really?
I mean,
what do you mean?
I mean, when you want to shoot up and there's no vending machine around, what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have to get Could you take me over to the vending machine? I need to like get a clean needle.
Yeah, well,
I just don't know if someone who's really jonesing and needs to get, you know, heroin is gonna bother going to the vet. It feels like a real, like a promotional thing for treatment, mm-hmm. which I'm, you know, we're all in support mm-hmm. of like increased treatment for and access to it. So it kind of feels like a sort of branding.
I think they are doing that.
It's a visible way of saying to a community, there are people around here who need these needles, but more than that, they need treatment.
Yeah, absolutely. They do need treatment. I think the part of it that makes me worry is that you have to be registered as part of this program because a lot of people are distrustful of, you know, they don't trust organizations and they don't trust the government and they're worried that they're gonna be on some sort of list and they're gonna be monitored and it could negatively impact their lives, whether it's with employment or whatever. And so I think that two things need to happen for this to actually be effective. You raise a good point because if it's not readily available or accessible, if you're an addict and you want to shoot up, I mean, you'll probably go ahead and share a needle. So I think it's more important to have it like more accessible. But I don't think that people should have to register. I feel like it needs to be something that's available to anyone who has this problem. And I agree with you about treatment. They need treatment as well, obviously. And unfortunately, we don't have enough politicians who wanna move in that direction.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that might be the aim of registration, is to track patients and their progress.
Yeah.
Because they do seem to kind of co-join, you know, this with treatment options or rehab references.
Right.
So that might be the point of registration. But again, folks are very distrustful about registering and identifying themselves as drug users in some kind of, you know.
Anything that disrupts the traditional sort of sensibility and convention about drug treatment and who's doing drugs is good. I mean, because it clearly hasn't fucking worked for many, 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 many years.
I know.
And now that it's sort of like really taking hold in these little tiny small towns all over, you know, a little town near where I grew up in Ohio, where you have people just struggling with this opiate epidemic. I mean, you know, people are not prepared. And so this is a kind of story and or a piece of technology that gets people to pay attention.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's a good thing.
Absolutely. You know? All right, guys, we got to take our first break. Let's do that and tweet to us using the hashtag TYT Lives. We will TYT Live. We will read your tweets when we come back. And when we come back, the story that I've been promising you, the $1,700 jeans. Hey guys, welcome back. All right, I have to make a point about something. I guess someone in the company accidentally ordered this size for the iPad. And I don't understand why this tablet even exists. Like, what's the point? I mean, I'm sure there's like some artist or someone out there who's like, no, you don't understand. Like the tablet, like it has to be that size. Like the whole point of the tablet is like, oh, it's easy and portable. And now every time we want to read the tweets, I'm like,
it's huge.
It's like so heavy. Okay, anyway. All right, so I want to read some member shout outs. Martha Johnson and Brandon Cook, you guys are awesome. And so are all of our members. You guys help support the show and keep us independent and allow us to talk about stories that we really want to talk about, like the story about the $1,700 pants that show your butt cheek. You don't want to miss that story. It's freaking awesome. We have pictures. We have pictures. All right, and then some TYT lives for you. Gabby Marita says, if the US is warehousing people, perhaps we should apply a different term for it, concentration camps. Damn. Darrell Deshawn says, private prisons, aka new form of slavery. You know, so if you go back a few years and look at Arizona's anti-immigration law, I believe it was SB 1070. You should take a look at the lobbyists behind that legislation. Mm-hmm. Private prisons were behind that legislation because they're like, absolutely, let's imprison some more undocumented immigrants. We get to make money. It's a very corrupt system and it makes me crazy. Rafer Madness says the safe injection sites in Vancouver also give addicts and homeless people access to counseling, which is a big part of recovery. I love that. Like, it's more comprehensive than vending machine. Right. I mean, the vending machine is good, it's a start, but you need something more comprehensive. Yeah. And Laura P.S. says, there is a solution. It is called treatment. I support sharp programs, but this is just a much cheaper Band-Aid on a bullet hole. Yeah, I think most people agree with that. You need more, but we're so backwards as a country when it comes to anything related to drugs that any type of progress makes me hopeful. So hopefully they'll build on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it goes back to the whole like empathy shortage we have. Like, it doesn't really matter until it's your kid who has the drug problem. It doesn't, gun control isn't an issue until your kid is gunned down. You know, gay rights isn't an issue or bullying legislation.
Is it? Yeah.
I don't understand why we can't feel empathy toward people who, and we're talking about lots and lots of people who suffer with addiction. And they're the first programs that get cut in budget, states cut in any kind of budget war. And yet, you know, not to get too philosophical about it, but we're going to do a one-off on a bomb that, you know, cost $18 million to kill 31 people. I mean, let's take $18 million and help 3,100 people.
And people salivate over that. Yeah, you know? People salivate over that. Like, it's amazing. I think one of the biggest takeaways from what we're experiencing with this heroin epidemic is this huge double standard regarding demographics.
Of course.
Because heroin, one of the most serious hard drugs out there, is now thankfully being treated as an issue where people need to be rehabilitated. Mm-hmm. Whereas for the longest time, people of color who got caught with marijuana would get imprisoned or they would get prosecuted to the fullest extent because, oh, look at them, they're junkies, they're addicts, you know, the throwaways of society, they're just trying to cause some trouble. But now all of a sudden, the demographic has totally shifted. If you look at the people in this country who are the most addicted to heroin, it's actually white, working class and middle class individuals, and politicians have completely changed their tone.
Well, I'm glad that
they have, but the double standard exists, and I think everyone needs to be aware of that.
It was a huge Rust Belt issue in the campaign, and it's also it would have been a slam dunk for the president in the first 100 days to, with a stroke of a pen. What if he'd held up one of those orders that he was so proud of doing every day that said something about, you know, some executive order that increased the number of treatment centers in every city in America. Think about how many people he'd win over, but he doesn't give a shit.
No.
But, really, but, he
here's, but here's the thing that drives me nuts. Like, he could win a lot of people over by signing executive orders like that. But right now, he's actually winning some people over by, you know, being a warmonger, by using, you know, military force. I mean, his approval rating is still relatively the same, but you hear the tone change in the mainstream media in regard to his foreign policy. It went from, oh, he doesn't know what he's doing, what's going on, to he's being presidential. You know, Brian Williams talking about how beautiful our weapons are. Right. Things have really, you know, shifted in terms of the coverage. And it's much easier for him to drop bombs than do something of substance. And sure. And that's the unfortunate reality of it. Mm. All right, moving on to other news. Teachers are making a killing by selling some of their resources and lesson plans on sites like Teachers Pay Teachers. Now, there's an interesting debate going on regarding the ethical and legal ramifications of these sites. However, Teachers Pay Teachers contends that it hit a milestone last year when its 80,000 contributors earned more than $100 million and that at least a dozen have become millionaires since the site launched a decade ago. Now, these are grade school teachers that literally sell the lesson plans that they've created or that they should have created and have utilized in their classrooms. And it's not just lesson plans. Maybe it's, you know, certain resources like a particular test that they've given their students or a particular activity that they've designed for their students. And so what it does is it saves a lot of time for new teachers so they can actually, you know, spend their time outside of the classroom doing other things. But again, there might be some issues here. So at Teachers Pay Teachers, these educators set their own prices for 2.5 million resources and give a commission to the site. With a $59.95 premium membership, the commission is 15%. With a basic or a free basic membership, it's 40%. So the site takes a cut of these transactions. Mm-hmm. But apparently a lot of people really like it. Legal experts, though, question whether teachers actually have ownership of the lessons they are selling. So I have more details, but what do you guys think about this?
Ownership of the lessons that they're selling, I think, is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I think the question of who owns ideas, mm-hmm. if I create an idea in the context of my job, does that mean that my job owns my intellectual labor, right, or the products of my intellectual labor? I think that's an interesting question. I think the lawyer should stay out of it unless they're, you know, arguing on behalf of teachers making more money.
Yeah, I mean, well, okay, so there's an interesting thing that I didn't know about. Some teachers have like a contract, like a contractual agreement mm-hmm. indicating that whatever it is that they're teaching in the classroom actually belongs to that school. Mm-hmm. And so if they sign off to it and then they proceed to sell their lesson plans on this site, they could lose their job or deal with some sort of lawsuit. I don't know what it is.
So the lesson plan is intellectual property and it belongs to the public school system in that employs the teacher?
In some circumstances. Okay. Not in all. So let me give you some more details on it. Sometimes they're super easy small purchases like $1.20 here, $2.50 there, and sometimes they're larger. One teacher says, I try not to spend over $15. She estimated that her prep time for school plummets from 20 to 30 hours a week to 2 hours if she can find what she needs online. Mm-hmm. So this is very different from what you experience on a college level, because on a college level, I think as a professor or a lecturer, you have to kind of, you should craft your own syllabus. But because things, you know, your teaching style might differ. With grade school, math, science, I mean, things are kind of standardized. And so you can't, I don't know. I don't know how to explain it. But I was kind of wondering, because I think it's really important for you as a teacher to create your own lesson plan, because you're more attached to it. You're fully equipped to teach it. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about all of it. You know, on one hand, I hate the fact that, you know, teachers get paid so little, and it's not just about their time in the classroom. Outside the classroom, they do even more work. So if this provides resources for them to do their job more effectively, I'm all for it. I just worry like that some teachers might abuse this and take some shortcuts. And you know, I don't know. I don't know what I'm talking about.
I'm all for it, I think. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's like one of those things where it's like capitalism and profit motive actually is like incentivizing learning, incentivizing time efficiencies, helping to supplement incomes of people who like need to be making more money so they, because they work their asses off. they won't have to go sell their shoes online or something else to make money.
Yeah.
Or take a second job. I think every teacher I ever had too in school, it was like, it wasn't so much like their lesson plan. It was like their charisma, their personalities, their passion for the topics and things that I remember most. And they're willing to like spend a little time with me after school or after class to that kind of like work on things.
Sure.
So,
that's important.
I mean, I think it's pretty standard stuff, pretty much, I mean, uniformly across school districts, what they're tested on.
That's right.
So
yeah.
I mean, you touched on that. Yeah. So, you know, look, I mean, hey, yeah, let's let teachers make some cash.
Yeah. Oh, I have no problem with that.
And let's make it tax free. I support that.
And I think that there's a way in which even this process is much like, I work in academia, so when I have to create a syllabus, I go and I look at other syllabi, right? And that process helps me construct a syllabus that is still very much my own. So it's not so much stealing as it is kind of an integrative process. So I think if that helps teachers expand whatever their framework for teaching is, maybe it's an activity or it's a resource that they wouldn't have thought of because they're not artsy or they, you know, it just, I think it expands the toolkit that teachers have available to hopefully teach better and to cut time doing it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know, I was asked to speak in a school of like sixth graders down in Florida for after I did How the States Got Their Shapes. I spent like an hour in that classroom and I don't know how that teacher survives.
I mean, that's all day with that many kids.
I can't even take care of a puppy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like nuts.
Grade school is no joke.
No, it
it's
is
no joke.
And they're constantly telling this and managing 32 kids, if they're lucky. And that's, God, can you imagine then having to leave that job and then plan for the next day?
I can't imagine. So again, on a college level, it's a completely different animal. It's, in my opinion, much easier. I could not teach sixth graders. I mean, because of the fact that you have to like discipline and educate simultaneously, and that is not an easy thing to do. They have the hardest job. So I don't want anyone to misinterpret what I'm saying. I'm not trying to be like overly critical. I just want to make sure that the teachers are as, I guess, like their lesson plan is something that they're actually involved in. You know what I'm saying? Like if you're collaborating and you're using the site to collaborate, that's great. But on a college level, for instance, sometimes you get professors that literally just use someone else's syllabus.
Sure.
And then you don't get anything out of the class or it doesn't feel as effective because that educator just isn't passionate. They're looking for a shortcut. So I worry about that a little bit. But if it's used as a way to collaborate and get really good ideas from other teachers and kind of craft your own lesson plan, then that's awesome. I think that's a really great idea, you know?
Yeah,
I think it might be a way. I worry about those impositions more from like the district and like whatever that, you know, public or private school framework. I remember dittos. I remember the things that were just kind of like the basic fundamental activities that were boring. And it seems to me that these teachers are actually selling resources and exams that come from their own creative process that might liberate teachers from some of those boring frameworks that we kind of replicate over time. So I'm an advocate.
If we called them, if we called them personalized textbooks, nobody would give a shit. I mean, their school districts spend gazillions of dollars on textbooks.
Yeah, they do.
Why not let teachers like write their own?
Yeah.
As long as they're vetting this stuff and making sure that it's accurate, and there's, you know, and most schools do.
It's the quality control that I think is more.
Well, if somebody, you know, if some kid comes home and says, "Mom, I didn't know that Martin Luther King Jr. today said this," and it's like, "Was that lesson plan from what the '60s? What are you? Why? Where did you get that? My teacher gave it to me." So, I mean, I think. As long as they're relevant and they're vetted,
it's all good.
Make some cash.
All right.
And
these teachers
do teach
some money.
Martin Luther King, because some of our folks are not aware of his great contributions.
Yeah, that's
as we've seen.
Are you referring to Jeffrey Lord?
I don't know.
The circus that is CNN.
I mean, no one would be talking about CNN if it weren't a circus, right?
I mean, pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think that's their corporate strategy.
It is their corporate strategy from a programming standpoint. I mean, it worked for them throughout the entire election. Let's find the craziest
people. The provocative bullshit
the
we can throw out there.
Because otherwise, no one's talking about CNN. Who cares about CNN? Right? And so I was always wondering, why do they keep having Scotty Nell Hughes on? She's insane.
Oh, man.
Why do they keep having these crazy people on? And it's because that's how they stay relevant. It's depressing. No publicity is bad publicity for them, but whatever. Anyway, moving on to some other news. There's a new type of church in Denver, Colorado. It is referred to as the International Church of Cannabis, where the congregation will consist of elevationists. That's what they refer to themselves.
Elevationism.
Elevationism, yeah. So this is fun. I like this. This is the kind of church I like. The church's stated purpose is to serve as a home to adults everywhere who are looking to create the best version of themselves by way of sacred plant. Okay, so the programming is expected to include guest speakers, comedians, artists, musicians, and film screenings. And so the amazing part about all of this is, look, people are criticizing it because they think it's just going to be like a marijuana smoking club, like people are going to get together and light up. But apparently no marijuana will be sold at the church. I mean, they might be consuming it, but the sale of marijuana is not allowed. And also, if you practice a specific type of religion, let's say you are Jewish or you're an evangelical, you are welcome to come to the church. You are allowed to be part of the International Church of Cannabis and still believe in your own faith.
Maybe.
is it a can evangelism? Evangelist?
Who runs that? I mean, if so, I will have a
church
completely
different
view of them.
I grew up in a Baptist church. It was really boring. But can you imagine how boring this church would be? Where the guy standing or woman standing up at the top going, oh my God, you guys, I saw the craziest thing today. And goes into a crazy detail about stuff.
Yeah.
Because he or she's so stoned.
I feel like it'd be
a lot of
fun. Do you
get to have pizza after this church?
I hope so.
You gotta be sponsored by somebody.
When the worship ceremony is over, there's pizza and Cheetos?
There has to be. Hopefully not while
that
it's
would
over,
be fun.
While it's happening. No. I actually disagree with you. I think this would be a lot of fun. First of all, I love those conversations if I'm under the influence of the devil's lettuce.
If you're at home, right? Like, but like if you're in church, I mean it.
Oh yeah, I'd get paranoid actually.
I bet you every sermon ends with, wait a minute, what was I talking about?
Probably.
What is the definition of church? Are they calling it a church just because it's housed in a facility that actually used to be a church? Or like what?
I don't know. I'm curious to see if they're referring to it as a religion or a church because of the fact that we have tax exempt status for churches. Mm-hmm. Maybe not. I don't know what their financial intentions are at all, so I don't want to be unfair to them. But I think that these are just like-minded people that want to get together and have some fun. By the way, this is the facility that it will be in. It's a 113-year-old structure in Denver's well-heeled Washington Park neighborhood. I wish I lived in Denver. I never ever thought I would say that about any place other than Los Angeles, but I want to visit this. It looks amazing.
For a tour. I worry about this notion of this is the place. Not worry.
Look at that picture. You have a sort of a storky looking person with breasts on the left.
Interesting.
And a man of brick with a beanie on. I mean, if that doesn't send you into some kind of psychosis while you're at church.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Right. Look, I gotta be honest, I would get paranoid. Like now that you really describe it and make me think about it, I'm like
alongside the pictures.
Well, remember Andrew Keegan when we were here together at the Young Turks, he's an actor who started a church in Venice. He started his own church. And I'm not saying that he's has an elevationist church or that marijuana is like the spine of their philosophy. But they just started a church.
Yeah.
There's this sort of sense of community that they're trying to build. You know, and I don't know what they do in these ceremonies, but it looks like they have like drumming and poems and music and just love.
It's like a hippie fest.
And they just, it's kind of like a hippie fest, I think, is what it is.
It's either going to be great or it's going to fall apart because this notion of this is a place where everybody can come and be their best self. Sometimes me being my best self means that I'm infringing on your best self. So I just, these loose, you know, ideas and how they're going to operate and people are going to be high. It's just, not be great.
I'm a big supporter. I love it.
I like it too.
Worship
and I'm curious about it. Let's hear from the co-founder, Lee Molly. She says, Elevationism is about elevating one's life and spiritual self-discovery through the sacrament of cannabis.
Ooh, kind of sacrament.
I grew up in an evangelical Pentecostal religion with people speaking in tongues and falling on the floor. Mm-hmm. If those people are considered a real religion, then why not us?
Okay.
That's a devastating point. Got to keep it real.
And now the sacrament of cannabis. The Pope has this most amazing sacrament of cannabis. I don't know if you guys have seen it. Leave out rattlesnakes too. Rattlesnake handling. I mean, a lot of us
people
had to go through
that
too.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of weird shit that is constitutes a religion. So why not the pot people?
Yeah.
But I just want to know what the cannabis sacrament is.
Yeah, same.
Like,
same.
Is there a thing?
Let's go investigate, Brian. You and I, let's go investigate. Let's do a show about it.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Investigative reporting at its finest.
Absolutely. All right, let's take one more break and then a cheeky story for you when we come back.
Yeah.
You keep going.
What's up, everyone? Anna, Brian, and Ambria with you. I do want to read a few TYT lies because we got a very strong reaction about the teachers pay teachers story. And I'm actually happy about it because a lot of you are educators and you've used it yourselves. Our very own Chris Hook has used it. He was a teacher. And he says, I used to use teachers pay teachers. It's a great site. And I know teachers who still use it. Huge time saver. Lesson planning is exhausting, especially when you have five or more different classes you need to prep for with 180 school days. That's 900 lesson plans or lessons you need to plan a year.
Wow. Yeah.
It's insane when you put it in that context.
Yeah.
Liquid Beef says, it worked that way at college as a student. Anything we created that took off or got a lot of public attention was their property, referring to the contracts that some schools have. Also, someone else talked about the teacher. Applejack says, I am a teacher who spends a lot of time on teachers pay teachers. Very few teachers can do it all alone. I love that the money goes to fellow teachers, which I agree with. I think that it's important, especially considering how underpaid educators are in the country.
Yeah.
So.
And by the way, I had a couple of teachers in like my high school that were using their own lesson plans that they hadn't updated for 35 years.
I
remember Mr. Trotless teaching world history, and literally the pages were yellow and ripped and paper clipped and all this shit. And you knew that he had never really done anything that was remotely topical. With all due respect to Irv Trotless, thank you for your incredible education that you gave me.
Yeah.
But wow, that guy needed a little, what do you call this website?
Teachers Pay Teachers.
Get relevant teachers.com. Yeah, that's the one. I think it's a good thing.
I think it is too. You guys have convinced me. Thank you for sharing your thoughts on it. And let me read a few more TYT lives that are not related to Teachers Pay Teachers. Michael Ritchie says, if the weed church fails, there's still there's still Unitarian Universalist churches, and those brothers and sisters are way chill.
Yes, they are.
Good to know.
They are.
Good to know.
I know some Universalists, and I love them.
Backup plan, guys.
I love anything that's
And the
that's
Unitarians
way chill.
Are terrific as well. Mm-hmm. And the Quakers are nice as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like the meeting. What, you're laughing at me? Okay.
It just keeps getting better.
Let's talk about these jeans.
Let's finally do the jeans story. You guys have been waiting for it. Okay. This is like such an old school type of story that we would do in the second hour. Like these ridiculous, human interest stories. Anyway, moving on. Rich people love to spend their money on things that make them look bad. Case in point, a new pair of pants from Ventimins. That's the name of the brand. Apparently, they did some collaboration with Levi's to create a $1,715 pair of pants. That's how much these pants cost. Now, what do they look like? Are they, you know, are they like plated in gold? Like, they're so expensive. They must be like super fancy. They must make you look really, really rich if that's how much they cost. Except no, they make you look like you're homeless. Let's take a look. Why? But why? But why? I don't understand. How is this allowed? How is anyone gonna spend money? And so you'd probably think there's no way that people are gonna buy this, except they are sold out on the Vetamin or whatever.
What is going on right there?
Okay, let's talk about that for a second.
What's happening?
Let's talk about that for a second. First of all, that is a very cute booty. Okay, so good for
Incredible
her.
Incredible butt.
Right. So I wouldn't blame her for wanting to show it off. Now, the pair of pants have like these zippers that, you know, you can zip all the way up or halfway up. And so if you feel like showing a little
chic
that day.
Why am I taking notes?
I know. Honestly, I saw like, you in okay, my wait, periphery. No, I'm so like, okay, she's totally into the
sold
pants.
Out.
So it's kind of like a hatch, like a door. There's a door in the back.
Yes.
Is it Velcro or is it a zipper?
It is a zipper.
It's a zipper. Okay.
Yeah.
So you need someone to help you with it.
Not necessarily. No. I mean, I feel
like
accessible.
It'd be, yeah.
You know where this is all headed, this conversation.
Yeah. So
let's just put up the warning now.
Only yeah. women? So,
I've only seen pictures for women. I'm not.
See, I think that's.
Oh, you're
central.
So you see opportunity.
I don't know if we're having the same.
You see opportunity for men to have them too.
Well, they should be unisex. I thought they were unisex.
Oh my god,
pants.
You guys, I'm so naive. I'm such an idiot. Like, of course that's what the pants are for. That's why they cost so much money, right?
Well, it's exposes the butt and the knees, two integral components of any kind of salacious activity.
So, first of all,
we have to ask ourselves,
yes.
There must have been some market research done that said, asks a group in a focus group, how many of you would like to have sex with your jeans on? Let's see a show of hands. Clearly there was a majority. Thank you so much. Levi's races back to the lab. Quick.
No, but
I need a door in the back, easy access, in and out. Let's get cracking. Go. And you know what? Don't make them $110.
Yeah.
Let's put these in Urban Outfitters. Let's put them online for $1,715, and they're sold out.
They're sold out. There's only one site. They're sold out on Nordstrom's website. So they sold them at Nordstrom's, and enough people were into it that they're gone. You can't buy it there anymore. So you can buy it on Net-A-Porter.
Sounds suspicious.
That is a.
That sounds.
What
like
is
setup.
That though? Is that the zipper's been opened, and that's what it looks like when it's been opened?
On that person. Yes.
Is there a flap there? I'm not really seeing. Is that what that is on the left?
No.
It's kind of pulled over, like so, exposing the left buttock.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes. But hold on. We need to focus on the details of this image, because if you look at this Instagram post from the website or from the retailer,
a lot of likes.
Look at how many likes.
Yeah.
People are into it.
No, sure.
Maybe, I don't know. Maybe this is an example, or maybe this is just like a sign that I've gotten old and I don't understand things. Because
what?
I just feel like this is A, unattractive, super unattractive. B, too expensive. And C, if you're really buying this to wear jeans while you have sex, like take your jeans off, right?
It's harder than it sounds.
It addresses a bigger issue, I think.
Like what?
There's a denim bubble.
Is there?
There is a denim bubble.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, like real estate, denim. Have you tried to buy a pair of jeans lately and seen like how expensive they are? And I think the denim bubble is going to burst. I think.
I mean,
here we go.
This denim bubble is definitely.
This
about
is
to
a
burst.
Denim. We are in a denim bubble.
Burst
so
on the denim
for people
bubble.
Who are going out and spending $1,715 on assless jeans,
ass optional.
That shit will be marked down next Christmas. Seriously, it's got to come down. There's got to be a ceiling for denim prices.
I mean, I think we're very
close to it.
It appears that way.
Yeah.
I'm no expert in denim real estate, but I'll tell you right now, we're in a bubble.
We are in a bubble. I just hope that no one, you know, bought these jeans with an adjustable interest rate, because that would be a nightmare. And we don't want to have the denim bubble burst and have lives ruined as a result.
You do have to make
really
monthly
bad,
payments
guys.
On this.
It's really bad.
You would have to.
Yeah, I mean, it's
$1,700. Hey, those are cool jeans. Imagine that conversation. Hey, those are really cool jeans. Anna, I love your jeans. Brian, it has a door in the back where I can just pull that down, or in case I just want to feel the nice cold chill of a seat on my bare ass.
You know?
And I paid, guess how much they were? I don't know. Anna, how much were they? Like, did you get them on sale? I didn't. $1,750.
When you say,
online.
$1,750.
Yeah, they came right to my house. It's awesome. Anyway, I gotta go.
I feel like you're a sharp-dressed gentleman, right?
Hey, mm-hmm. There's a corduroy version.
Oh, okay.
Cords, excellent.
So it's not just denim.
Yep.
Where are you going with this?
I mean, maybe there's a corduroy bubble as well, but we just weren't aware of it. I have no idea. But
since
I was
the 70s.
I was gonna ask you guys, what is like the priciest like piece of clothing that you've bought?
That's a good one. With or without an ass in it.
Do you have clothes that
I have chaps.
You do have chaps.
I do, because I ride horse.
Oh, okay.
And I ride Western, uh-huh. And so I actually have chaps. And frequently I wear them around the house with nothing under them, just to get that sense. And clearly they're
magic
catchy.
Mike-ish.
I do have chaps, but I never thought about wearing them without anything under them. But they go over your Wranglers.
Right.
Yeah. The most expensive thing I ever bought was probably like a suit.
Yeah, I see.
You know, where you went and said, you know, I'm going to go in here, I'm going to get this tailored, and it's going to be, but I still have that suit.
Mm-hmm. Good. Yeah.
I mean, for years and years, yeah, I've had the same suit.
When it comes to staples, right, not this kind of stuff, like stuff that's going to be timeless. Like, I think it's worth it to spend a little bit of money and get a good quality item. I really like going to secondhand places like consignment shops, because rich people, especially in Los Angeles, buy things that they never use and then they end up giving it to these consignment shops. And I'm like, I'm gonna snatch that shit up. And I
would just love to be there in 30, 40 years when you're wherever you're retired to, and you're in a vintage store and these jeans are there. And you'll remember this conversation.
I would die.
Hear those assless jeans.
I do.
Whatever the cost.
Whatever the cost. I mean, hopefully by then the bubble will burst and I can get them for a really good price. You know?
Let's stop.
Yeah.
The denim bubble. I'm telling you, there is a denim bubble.
Oh, God. All right, guys. Thank you so much for watching. Brian Unger, Ambria Allen. Where can they check you guys out?
Top secret stuff. I'll be in my bunker this weekend.
Follow me on Twitter, Instagram, at Ambria.
Awesome. All right, guys. Thank you so much for watching. We will see you next week. Have a
great
weekend.
Bye, everybody.